They were high school sweethearts that got married and had two kids. It's the Brunettes. From a new location, they tweet all day, but that's okay. They're the Brunettes. She is a journalist. He is a wonk.
Wonk, wonk, wonk.
They talk about the news or whatever they want. In the fight for justice, they're on your side. You can't deny it's the Brunettes.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our low-effort, low-quality podcast. This is Liz Brunig. This is my husband, Matt.
Hello, everyone.
Why not just start the day fucking it up?
You know, we did have a failed cast ahead of this one that...
Now, we spent about 10 minutes before I realized I hadn't clicked record. So, well, we'll just hop in. We didn't go too far. Thankfully, Liz caught it.
Yeah,
we spent a whole hour on it.
Yeah, that would have been hugely demoralizing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would have been it for a month of podcasting.
Matt's about to head out to the land of Texas. As many of you all know, we're trying to get you all caught up on content in the meantime.
Yep.
So today we have a special Q&A cast prepared for you.
We sure do.
I think we should just take it from the top.
Let's hop in. Number one question.
Thoughts on homeschooling?
Not for. Against.
And you're against it. You're going neg on homeschooling.
Against.
I think, you know, there are situations where I can understand why it's the best option for a family if the child has very special health care needs or other special needs. If
they live out in a remote settlement.
Very remote somehow. You're like living on an island off Alaska or whatever.
Traveling carnival worker.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I can understand in various circumstances why it makes the most sense. But as a general matter, I think the socialization effects of school are important. And I think going to school also, allows, you know, other adults in the community to monitor the child for signs of neglect and abuse. And I think that's very important.
Yes, and schools are important centers of child culture, such
yes.
as it is. It's not just you go and learn. There's also athletics. There's theater. There's art. There's band. There's all these other activities, dances,
yes.
that are all coordinated through the school. And I think it's important to let your kids, you know, be engaged in all of that, you know. So I wouldn't pull out for that purpose.
It seems developmentally important, and it seems developmentally important that kids have relationships with their peers. I know homeschooling doesn't necessarily preclude all this because there are homeschooling leagues where they get the kids together and so on and so forth.
Sure, but...
So I don't want to...
It's not the full reach of things. And the other thing is, so, you know, there's obviously an affirmative case for why going to school is good.
Yeah.
What's the case for why people want to homeschool? And typically it seems like it's because they think that, well, if I send the kids off to school, we're going to lose them in some respect because they're going to be taught the wrong things. And it's usually a religious thing or a sexual thing or a
combination of both.
Yeah, it's, you know, whatever. It's kind of a socially conservative notion. And I think that stuff's just way overblown. And I feel like, I don't know, when they say things to me like that, I just don't understand why, what school they went to or what their impression of school is. The degree to which you can just kind of like thrust something upon a kid through the schooling system, I think it's a lot harder than you can imagine. Most kids are pretty... I wouldn't say they're checked out. They're there to make the grade and whatever, but they're not, it's not like, oh, well, they taught them sex ed, and so now they're going to be ruined. It's like, that's something you're still somewhat in control of as a parent.
You still have a lot of capacity to influence the child, and I think also on the flip side of that, it's not as easy as you may think to avoid the entire world, right? Even if the kid is not in school, they're still going to be receiving messages from pop culture.
Yeah, that's a very good point. If your strategy for protecting the kid is a strategy of total sheltering from exposure to things, that's going to be a fail strategy.
Yeah, I would think in a lot of cases. Yeah.
Your strategy will have to involve making them resilient to alternative messages if that's your game, you know? Yeah. And so since you're already going to have to do that anyways, send them to school, you know, if that's what you're worried about.
Just on a personal level, I could not do homeschooling. That is beyond my capacities.
Yeah. Are you asking me, do I want to school my kids? No.
No.
You know, I'll help them with certain things. Do I want to spend hours and hours each day being their teacher?
Being their sole instructor in every curriculum.
100% not.
No, I am not up to the task. What is the best cookie and why is it the Snickerdoodle? The Snickerdoodle is a goated cookie. It's an extremely good cookie.
I will say, I
feel like people who put cream of tartar in them and who are very interested in like a puffy, cakey Snickerdoodle, I part ways with them. I don't understand that. I like a dense, chewy Snickerdoodle, personally.
Yeah, I don't want a pastry like entity.
It's not the experience I'm looking for in a cookie.
I actually don't know enough about cookie types. I will say cookie is probably my favorite. Cookie and ice cream are my favorite dessert-like things.
Child-ass taste over here.
Well, when you get into like cake and pie and advanced croissants and whatnot, I'm like, they're okay. But like the cookie and the ice cream or the cookie and the milk, I guess, because that gives you the cream element of it. That's number one. So, I mean, I don't know how you go wrong necessarily with just like, I mean, what I think of is like chocolate chip. You know, but like you could kind of just mix in whatever.
Yeah.
Like the basic base of whatever a chocolate chip is, and then you put the chips in it.
Yeah.
Like I think you see lots of variations on that.
Yeah. Like a brown sugar.
Yeah. Like whatever it is, you're putting M&Ms in there, or you're putting other like caramel in there, or brownie bits, or whatever.
People
go all sorts of ways with like the chips element of it, or maybe they even put some stuff into the base. I don't know if these are correct terms, but. That is a pretty solid platform for flavor, I would say.
Yeah. We recently made chocolate M&M cookies.
Those
were pretty good. The kids came up with their own recipe.
Yeah, the kids wanted to make chocolate cookies that had M&Ms with them, which normally you would not do because it obscures the M&M. It doesn't pop.
Just double chocolate. Yeah.
But they were damn good.
The kids, they decided that's what their recipe design was, a chocolate cookie base with M&Ms. We use Trader Joe's M&Ms. They were cute. They were pretty good. Aliens land in your yard. You're the first human they've met. How do you sell them on the one holy, the apostolic church? Firstly, my yard's very small, so I'm relieved that these aliens are not like enormous and intimidating like giants. I'm glad to know that they're, you know, sounds like basically humanoid. I would just be like, do you guys have death? Do you have dying? Can you die? Okay, we have that, but we have a cure for it.
That is an interesting question. That's the first question you want to establish with an alien, I think, is do you guys die or not? Because death is not a necessary outcome of living.
Yeah.
Right? That's
correct. Amundo, Matt.
Well, you could live forever, like if your body was, you know, like, and some people spend
you will live forever.
A lot of research and time trying to figure out how to make it so that your body doesn't deteriorate. And I think there are some animals that basically live forever.
That they regenerate,
like thousands of years.
Certain kinds of worms
like
and whatnot.
That makes a big difference. Death is a big deal, man.
Death is a huge, it brackets every single thing you do every day.
it really affects everything.
The certitude of death, it influences every decision you make all day, every day. Mm-hmm. He's always there, the Grim Reaper.
Yeah And if we got rid of it, man, it would be a whole different world.
Do you want to put on Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult?
Not really No, I will though.
Yeah,
hopefully we don't get a takedown notice.
That's never happened to us. No, I don't think we're big time enough.
It doesn't happen on Spotify, only on YouTube. Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, no, everybody knows this song.
Well, especially me. Especially me, I know it.
Okay. I think that's what I would establish with the aliens, is whether they had death. And if they do have death, then I can sell them on the church because it has a cure for death inside of it. Recently got married and we moved to a new city together. As people who have moved around, any thoughts on meeting people or adjusting to life in a new city where you don't know people?
Don't meet anyone.
Thanks. You know.
Just fail at that entirely and just fucking keep trucking on. Like James Meredith said.
Yeah, been living a lonely life for a long time now.
They asked James Meredith. He was one of the integrators at, what was it, Alabama or something like that? At a Southern University.
Was it Ole Miss?
Maybe it was Ole Miss. And they said, how do you feel being lonely? You know, is it lonely out here? And he says, I've been lonely, living a lonely life a long time.
Yeah.
That's how to be. Most people look at that and they go, that's sad. I'm like, that's where I'm at. That's what I'm trying to be. I'm trying to get to that level. Or he's like, give a fuck.
You know, I think aside from that, you know, if you're folks who attend religious services, going to your local house of worship for whatever you may, need to practice, you know, that's a way to meet people.
Sports leagues.
If you have kids, the kids will put you in contact with other adults because they become friends with each other and then you meet their parents.
Mostly other women, though.
Yeah. Although you're good friends with Harlow Dad.
I'm not.
You know?
No, I take the kids to places all the time, and it's just women there, which, yeah. I mean, that's fine, but, you know, I feel like it's a slightly different dynamic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but, you know, if you like being friends with ladies, as I do.
Well, I do as well, but, yeah. You know, it's always a question there, you know?
That's true.
There's always a question about what's going on here.
Yeah.
Being a little too friendly, you know?
I think you just always have to have your friendly face on and don't be afraid to, like, ask other adults for their number just to hang out, which is kind of a weird thing to do, but, you know, sometimes you got to do it.
You do. You do. If you want to be successful, you got to put yourself out there. That's the part where I struggle.
Matt's take on having to denounce U.S. citizenship in order not to pay U.S. taxes if you live outside the U.S.
I don't have one. I don't have a take on that exactly.
Oppenheimer thoughts.
Nuclear bomb, bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately bad call, but it...
Wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't have made it.
Well, you know, their argument was like, well, if we don't make it, the Nazis will just make it first.
Maybe not. That would have been my counter.
All right.
That would have been my counter.
Right. All right. Let's see. I don't know. Oppenheimer, I would like to see it. I'm going to go with the Monique meme. I would like to see it, but I haven't had the opportunity yet. I hear it's a good film.
Oh, the movie. Yeah, I'm sure it is. He seems like on all the movie and all the stills of him, he looks like he's crying in shell shock the whole time.
Yeah, same. Honestly, that's me every day. So
now you are right though. There is a conundrum there where you are developing this and you're in a war and you're worried about the great evil also developing it, but you know, it is an interesting moral conundrum, especially because you don't then get to decide what to do with it, right? Like, because you say, well, we needed it to preempt the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, but that's not even what we did with the bomb, you know? We didn't drop any bombs over there. So, but at that point, it's out of his control. So that's a rough one. It's a rough situation to be in.
It is. Yeah, I think ultimately, if it were up to me, I would not become Death, the Destroyer of Worlds.
But at the end of the day, you know, it kind of is fine. Like, you know, they used it twice. Awful.
Not good.
But, you know, everything's been clean since then.
I believe the Catholic Church has said that there is no licit use of nuclear weapons because they represent such a risk to
civilians.
About
to prevent an asteroid from hitting the Earth?
Yeah, I mean, against humans. Against people.
Oh, yeah.
The argument. But maybe we could use them against aliens.
What if you double affected? What if you did it through double effect?
Well, you know, what do you do if the aliens tell you they don't die? You're like, wow, damn, okay.
Man, we're on different levels, you and I.
Yeah, we're different. We're very different creatures.
How do I get to where you are?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know. I don't know if I don't want to die. I mean, it depends, I guess.
Just, yeah, maybe the conditions of living, et cetera.
Do you also get to hold aging back?
Yeah.
You know, because you don't probably don't want to be like 80 forever.
Yeah, no. Or just getting worse and more decrepit.
Yeah, at that level of keeper. Physical ability.
Yikes. You've mentioned The Sparrow by Maria Doria Russell before in relation to issues with the church. My question is who you would cast to make it an HBO blockbuster miniseries. Yeah, I don't know. Emilio Sandoz. He is the priest at the center of The Sparrow, which is a great novel, I think, one of the great novels of the sex abuse crisis. I don't know. Rami Malek, maybe?
The Weeknd?
No, definitely not The Weeknd. Okay. Definitely not The Weeknd. Turned out
you
that guy...
Gotta give him a second shot, though. You gotta give him a second shot.
Put him back in control of the miniseries. Yeah. How would you both deal with rude and mean-spirited coworkers, Matt?
Ignore them.
Okay. I try making peace with people. If they don't want to, there's really nothing you can do about that. So then I guess just ignore them.
All comes back around.
It all comes back around. Why do cars make sound when you drive them, when you drive by them, even if they not turned on?
You know, the Doppler effect?
I don't know.
That's a great question, though.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Something to do with the wind resistance.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Warping the sound. Yeah. It's wild how that happens. Good ear. Matt, what are your thoughts on the solution to climate change? Seems like you always have a simultaneously level-headed and contrarian take. That's my man.
That's a real demeaning description of it. Contrary? Yeah, reasonable always. I don't have that here. I mean, you know, I think the solutions to climate change are pretty well established, right? These are essentially technical questions.
Mm-hmm.
You need to replace all of the fossil fuel-based energy with non-fossil fuel-based mm-hmm. energy. And you also, therefore, are going to have to do a lot of electrification of things that currently can only run on fossil fuel energy, right? So it's sort of like decarbonize the electricity and then electrify everything that you can. And there are some hard things around the edges, like making steel or concrete or whatever, where it's a little bit difficult to see exactly how you decarbonize. But that's the big one. Decarbonize electricity, electrify everything. And then I think around the edges, obviously, you're going to need to do some carbon capture, direct air capture. If things get real bad, you're probably going to need to do some like geoengineering type stuff where you spray water in the air and stuff like that in order to refract some of the sun to keep things cool. I guess that would be the only thing that I believe that people sometimes get upset about is when you suggest that you should do like, you know, you should target solar radiation, solar type geoengineering, that should at least be on the table. And direct air capture also upsets people. But other than that, I don't really have a contrarian take. The issue here is just how do you get people on board to do this? Because decarbonizing all the electricity and electrifying everything costs. It's very costly.
Yeah.
Not just like, whoa, money. It's not just money. It's like you're going to have to assign tens of millions of workers to that job, to those jobs. And you're going to have to direct tons and tons of material to that job. And those workers and that material could be spent on something else. And so people are going to have to essentially sacrifice some of their well-being in the short term in order to decarbonize all the electricity and electrify everything. Mm-hmm. And at the end of all that, it's not really clear that like your living standard is improved.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that you've avoided catastrophe, which is good, but that's just a hard thing, a hard sell sometimes, you know?
Do you think there's a place for nuclear power in the future for the climate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the debate on that, again, is basically a technical question that people have about can you get nuclear power plants on line quickly enough? And yeah. I don't know the answer to that question. There's really heated debates. I have no fucking idea. Like, that's like an industrial question. Like, because people say, well, it takes 20, 30 years to build one of these. And then people come back and say, well, that's mostly a regulatory thing. And also there are these new, like, small modular reactors that people have come up with that could be built more quickly. And we're working on the technology there. And, you know, it's just like, to me, that's a technical industrial question that unless I am like a nuclear... someone who's an expert in the nuclear industry, I really am not in a position to know too much about. But I'm not against nuclear energy just across the board. I think some people, you know, certain kind of greeny types are find it distasteful, and I can't really say I fully understand where they're coming from. I think they're off on that and maybe are affected by just kind of the bad vibes of nuclear. That doesn't seem very green.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's carbon-free electricity, a lot of it in a small footprint, so.
Yeah, and it's also kind of cool, no? Like a little bit metal.
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested in that aesthetic, right, this sort of industrial kind of like that, and honestly, when I see people debate about it, it really kind of looks like two camps, like in which one camp... like they love like the trees and the forests and whatever, and like that's the aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And the other camp's like, I love hard industry. And you're like, okay, but we're really not about like what you want your like desktop wallpaper to look like at this moment. Where it's a different question, but these things bleed over.
Yeah,
these things bleed over aesthetics. They do. So.
My girlfriend and I have had a long-distance relationship for 3 years. We're moving in together next week. Any tips on how to manage this transition? We're both excited but nervous, especially because this is our first time living with a partner. You know, I would say you don't really need to, like, I think, sit down and make a, like, chores chart or anything. You can just kind of see how it naturally falls out with people kind of gravitating toward the tasks they want to do and that are suited for them. And then just try to, you know, be very courteous.
Yeah. And moving in together, it's more of a question of how do you co-manage household, which is a question of domestic labor. I would say definitely do your part, do as much as you can. And you want everyone operating in good faith about doing what they can, whether that's laundry, dishes, whatever. And like really seriously, doing what you can. I do think it's important as much as possible to keep those things fairly equally distributed, because it can feel unfair if they're not, but also that it's not good to keep like literal tallies, because then that can feel like a sort of surveillance and just a level of pedantry that you really don't want either. So at the end of the day, the way it all works is people have to be good faith actors and contributors.
You know, love one another, for love covers over a number of sins, as the good book says. Lowell, just popping in to say, I was going to ask two looking for advice type questions and then imagine the advice that would be given, which was sufficient to answer them. The brand is consistent. Anyway, will housing prices ever be where they were last decade, or am I fucked? What do you think, Matt?
Dude, if I knew where housing prices was going, I wouldn't be doing this fucking podcast. You know what I mean? if I knew of any asset class, if I knew precisely where the prices were headed, I would be, I definitely wouldn't be doing this to make money. So who knows? I do think hopefully interest rates will come down. That's a big aspect of this. But I don't know how quickly that will take, you know. I don't know. They may not come down. They might just stick here for a little bit. And that's really what's making things tough, because, you know, that means your mortgage payment's a lot higher because you're having to pay a much higher interest rate than people previously did. It's weird because, like, in theory, as the interest rates go up, you would expect the asset price to go down because people are less willing to pay as much as they used to pay for a house because they have to make the interest payment as well. But that is not what has happened. We've seen interest rates go way up because the Fed and housing prices have also continued marching up. So it's quite a hell of a squeeze. Now, of course, we could build a lot more housing. That might help a little bit, but it's tough. People don't like building housing.
I'm a school teacher in a state without a union, bleh, and many other teachers just accept other duties as assigned and as something giving principal pretty much carte blanche to exploit their labor. This can include things like covering detention unpaid or taking tickets at sporting events unpaid. I work at a more enlightened school where the principal demands we get paid extra for things or makes it so we don't have to do them. But what is the legality and limits of, quote, other duties as assigned for salaried workers?
If you're a salaried worker, right, you're not being paid hourly, then, you know, there's no limit on it. You know, they can have you do whatever they want you to do. It's up to you to negotiate, you know, your pay with respect to that. That's how it works. So absent a union, you're going to have trouble unless you're willing to quit or something like that. Like you're generally, you're just going to have trouble.
Climate change or global boiling? The gangs had little to say on the topic.
Yeah, we just did a climate change one.
Yeah, I think neither. I want neither of those. I've heard Matt say that baby bonds are stupid, but don't think I've heard his reasoning. Can you elaborate? DC just passed a baby bonds bill giving $1,000 a year until age 18.
Yes, baby bonds are stupid. And it's really unfortunate. It's so unfortunate that this has caught on. It's caught on because people have decided, like, you know, it's a racial justice thing. And
yeah.
It's being pushed by academics who have managed to kind of assign themselves the mantle of, like, the racial justice knowers. But the policy is garbage. It's just so bad. I'll give you an example of the Connecticut Baby Bond Program, which I actually wrote a piece about. You can look at it on People's Policy Project. The title is Why the Connecticut Baby Bond Program is Bad. Okay, so in this proposal, let's see what we got here. What they're trying to do, first things first, is they want to give like a chunk of money to people when they turn 18.
Okay.
That's the actual policy. It's weird because that would be called like young adult bonds.
Yeah.
But instead they call it baby bonds. The baby bond thing is a pure matter of framing.
Yeah.
Because you don't get the money until you're 18, which point you're not a baby. But it's not a matter just of pure framing, because the way it functions is all these programs, you start putting money, you give someone a chunk of money when they're born, and you might give them some beyond that, depending on how you structure it. In Connecticut, they were giving people $3,200 at birth. Only for the kids who were on Medicaid at birth, which is only 36% of the kids. So they're using whether you're on Medicaid as some kind of proxy of whether you're poor. Of course, this is absurd because whether you're on Medicaid when you're born has nothing to do with your financial circumstances when you're 18, but that's when they're giving you the money.
Yeah.
Okay? So the first problem here is if you want to give money to 18-year-olds, we'll give money to 18-year-olds right away. Next year, we'll have approximately, 3.5 million, 4 million people will turn 18. In your state, it'll be less than that, obviously, because each state has, you know, different populations. Just pass a bill that says when people turn 18, they get this money. What baby bonds does is it, quote unquote, gives them money when they're a baby, but then holds on to it for 18 years, which means the first person who will ever get a baby bond payment will not get a baby bond payment until like 2041. So what are we doing here? Like, why are we waiting until 2041 to make our first payment to 18-year-olds? Just make it right away. Right away, pass a law that says when people turn 18 in our state, they get this money.
Yeah.
You don't need this huge run-up. It's crazy to have this huge run-up. And there have been countries that have tried this before. In the UK, they did this. It was called like a child trust fund. The program lasted for about 8 or 9 years and then was scrapped before anyone ever got any money. It's hard to maintain a program that's costing money every year, but that delivers no benefit for 18 years. Remember, government's going to be changing hands over this time period. People are going to want the money for other purposes. Already in Connecticut, the governor is trying to like shut this shit down. He's like, this is a waste, and he's right. So the idea that this program is going to even survive to make its first payment is very, very implausible. And you really shouldn't even be gambling on that because you could make it to 18-year-olds right away. Now, in Connecticut, and this is what you've seen in a lot of these state-level programs, they put all these rules on them that are crazy. Not only, one, do you have to have been on Medicaid when you were born, but two, if you leave the state after you're born, you don't get it, right? So you're born there. Well, as our kids were born in D.C., now they don't live there. So if they had gotten a baby bond or whatever, the baby bond would just go away if D.C. has the same rules as Connecticut, which I bet it does, right? So right off the bat, only a minority of kids are even eligible because they have to be on Medicaid. And then of those, some percentage of those will leave the state before they ever turn 18, at which point the bond goes away. But then when you turn 18, and this again is in a lot of these rules, and this is for sure in Connecticut, you have to do like a financial literacy program. And then they don't just give you the money. You have to use the money on a particular thing. So you have to use it in Connecticut on buying a home, investing in a business in Connecticut, or education. So if you're someone who just graduates high school and wants to go directly into work, you're not starting a business, you're not going to college education, and you may not be able to buy a home or want to buy a home, right? You, that this may not be enough. Homes are expensive, right? So now you can't even get the money out.
Yeah.
Even if you've done all, even if you were born on Medicaid, stayed in the state for exactly for 18 straight years, which is not your choice because it'd be up to the parent, then you did the financial literacy course, then you applied and you still can't get the money out because there's nowhere you can put it.
Yeah.
It's trash. And like I said, the only reason, practically the only reason this is proliferating is because people who have been successful at appointing themselves the mantle of like racial justice knowers have pushed this. That's the only reason. And because it doesn't cost anything. And that's the other thing that's really funny about it is like, it's attractive to lawmakers because you have this group of advocates who go, this is how you can help close the racial wealth gap. And also it costs nothing. And they're like, fucking hey, hell yeah. We get a check mark on we did racial justice for something that costs very little without ever being like, if it costs very little, how much racial justice is it really doing? You know?
Yeah.
It seems like the gap there is pretty big. And if you're telling me we're just doing a tiny amount of filling of it, then that can't be a whole lot, can it? But, you know, they get the cover they want. It's sad. I think it's a sad example of bad policy that just happens to be connected to the right people. And it's moving through these state houses where no one is available to point out that this shit sucks. So
yeah. Liz, what are your thoughts on John Wesley today? Warm, you know, I don't have negative feelings. It wasn't that I was, you know, sort of pushed from being a Methodist. I was just pulled into being a Catholic. So, I don't have any hard feelings or anything like that. Have you tried halva? It's a sesame dessert that our friends bought back from Turkey. So good. Oh, yes.
I have had that, yes.
You used to buy it for me all the time.
At, what was that place called?
There was a place in Cambridge, was it not?
Yeah. Forgot what it's called now.
Matt used to buy me halva as a treat. Matt loves bringing me little treats.
That was my thing back in the day. I still do it.
This is, yeah, it's a courtship thing that's never ended, which is very, very sweet and endearing.
Yeah, every time I find a treat, a novel treat, or I see like an exotic, because it's always got to be a little bit exotic.
Yeah.
It's always like, oh, here's a Korean candy or something.
Yeah.
let's see what Liz thinks of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, anytime I can find some kind of exotic treat, I'm go ahead and pick one up for Liz.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely aspect of our marriage that if you're out on the town, I can always guarantee or you know count on you bringing.
I'm always looking. The kids love it too.
Always
now.
Scouting for treats. Yeah,
they love to get treats for mom.
Currently in the Netherlands and enjoying the hell out of fresh stroopwafels. Thoughts on the best international cookies, dude? Stroopwafels are so good. I would eat a pound of those.
That's the hard waffle with the caramel
with
in
the
it.
The caramel in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trader Joe's has those.
Pretty damn good. You can get the little bite-sized ones.
Yeah, those are tough. Those are definitely one where I got to be careful.
You'll get sick.
Yeah.
I'm pooping out blood.
I'm in the pain zone because I couldn't control myself.
You know, they're so good, though. I think international cookies, I mean, man, there's such a wide variety of cookies there. I love Quadratini. which are those little wafer cookies that come from Italy.
Yeah, I guess those I don't really know of internet. I like the Danish cookies, the Danish butter cookies.
I really enjoyed the Korean Oreos, the Korean cinnamon bun Oreos.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a good international cookie.
The Koreans and the Japanese have a lot of differently flavored Oreos and Kit Kats, and those are solid.
Yeah.
I don't know if a Kit Kat's a cookie per se.
Kit Kat has, it's a wafer candy. love international Kit Kats of all kinds. One time a tweep sent me like a just a solid box, like a brick, of Australian Kit Kats, which were insanely good. Any advice for parenting when you have a new infant and a five-year-old, e.g. tips on juggling care, making the current child not becoming jealous of the new sibling?
I can't say I have any success in that area.
The kids are insanely jealous of each other.
So jealous. Dude, our kid yesterday, she took the big one, the seven-year-old, took the four-year-old's like little unicorns, like this is like tiny little ball stuffy, and pushed it out the mail slot.
Yeah.
Just to make it inaccessible to her and taunt her.
Just to torment her. Yeah. Yeah. It's not good. It's not good. I think, you know, ideally you maybe try to recruit the five-year-old to help you with the baby and give her some ownership, him or her some ownership over the new sibling, you know, being a helper.
Yeah, I think that is the official recommendation, is you try to make them feel good about being the big sibling and doing big sibling things.
It's a new role.
And then they're like, oh, wow, I did something good. And then you encourage them, like, oh, that's so great when you do that. And then they feel good about like doing it. But I don't know if that works or not.
Both of our kids want to be the baby. So recently came across the term ALICE, Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. And I thought I was losing my mind. Seems to me like a technocratic, class-phobic rephrasing of working or middle class, but not meaningfully any more specific. Am I missing something?
Dude, I went to this website that they sent, United for ALICE.
Yeah.
Bleak shit. Bleak shit. yeah, I mean, it's funny, right? Low income, asset limit. So they're trying to, you know, knock those out, but they also want to insist that you're employed.
Yeah.
So it's like, and they're saying ALICE earns just above the federal poverty limit, but less than what it costs to make ends meet. So it's like this hyper specific slice of people, and they meet all the things. They're employed. That's always important. You know, it's got to be the working poor, but these people aren't actually poor technically. This is the working sort of poor, and they also don't have like wealth to back them up. Now this is just why. Why do we have to stratify to this extent? It's also just the case, and I mean, this is a point I've made over and over again about all this kind of stuff, is like ALICE does not refer to a static group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true for the poor. This is true for all of this. And once you get your head around this, a lot of things change in the way you think about, you know, the world and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
People who are ALICE 1 year, the majority of them are probably not ALICE the next year. You know what I mean? So you're talking about a location in the economic system. You're not talking about people. When you go to the website, they have like pictures of people and they're like, these are the ALICE people. And it's like, no, those people are ALICE some years and not other years.
Mm-hmm.
Just as some people are poor some years and not poor other years. What you have here are problems with the economic system and the set of possible positions in that system. And some of those positions are bad. And the way you fix those positions is by, you know, through economic policies that are, you know, focused on the general issue here, right? So a lot of the people who are ALICE, quote unquote, they probably have young kids. And that's really where their struggle is, right? Because if you're making, let's say, 30 a year as an individual, that's not, you know, great, I guess, you know, that's like 15 an hour or whatever, but you can survive on that. You can, like in most places, like that's definitely like doable, even if it's not great. You throw a couple kids in there and now you're in trouble. Well, we've got solutions for that. Child benefits fix that issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
or they might have a disabled spouse or an unemployed spouse or whatever. Like, all these things are fixed. And then at the end of the day, if what you're worried about is, well, but once you've fixed all that, there are still people whose wages are simply too low. Well, that's what the fucking unions are for, if you get that kicked off. So I just like to tackle each piece of the puzzle, you know, each individual piece of the puzzle. Benefits for kids, benefits for disabled, benefits for the elderly, benefits for the unemployed, higher wages at the bottom through wage compression. You tackle all that, then let the chips fall where they may, because however they align into households and stuff, it's going to work. But you start fixing on, this is a group, and we need to listen to Alice voices, and you've just gone off the wrong path.
Yeah.
You've gone off the wrong path. Because you're not going to learn anything from that particular fixation. The people who fall in this group overlap with other people who have similar problems. And you'll need to address those constituent problems, not treat this as like a class. That you just like address them sort of in an identitarian type fashion. But
the parable of the sower came up the other day, and my wife and I discussed that it seems difficult to understand as Catholics because the hints at predestination, with the good soil being the only ones where the word can take root, would be curious on your perspective. We're talking here about Matthew 13, the parable of the sower. It's right at the top there if you guys want to refer to it. I think the key in thinking about the parable of the sower is to recognize, you know, when Jesus does his exegesis and he explains what the parable is about, you know, he's talking about people who hear the message and don't understand it so that the evil one can snatch away what was sown in their heart. He's talking about people who hear the words once, receive it with joy, but then there's no really root for the faith. So it lasts only a short time and they quickly fall away. And then he's talking about people who become consumed by the deceitfulness and wealth of the world and so on, and, you know, become parted from it that way. And then there's people who are the good soil, who hear the word and understand it and produce a crop yielding 100, 60, 30 times what was sown. Yeah, I think, you know, the key here is just to recognize that we have some agency in which one of those types of people we are. So it's not simply predestined. These things are not necessarily strictly inborn. They have to do with a disposition you can cultivate in yourself. And that cultivation is part of the work of being a Christian, I would argue, is to become that good soil. And that, you know, you can see based on the other possibilities that Jesus talks about, where you might fall away from becoming that good soil. And that can be becoming, you know, consumed with the worries of this life. It can be, you know, only hearing it with joy briefly, you know, having little stamina in the faith and so on. These are things that are under your control to cultivate, is what I would say about that. Matt, can you explain your wrong year fallacy with the earned income tax credit? To my mind, the way the program is evaluated would make it more accurate, but I'm sure I'm not seeing something.
Yeah, okay, so this is very simple. Let's imagine that you're working in 2022, because the earned income tax credit is based on how much you earn. So let's say you earn $10,000 or whatever, and that makes it so that you're eligible for $3,000 from the EITC. You got it? So you earn 10 grand and your eligibility is 3,000 from the ITC. These are just made up numbers. I don't know what the precise number it is. Depends on your kids, all this kind of shit, whatever. Okay. So now the question is, in what year do you count the $3,000? So if it's 2022, you earn $10,000. Earning $10,000 makes you eligible for the $3,000 of EITC. But you do not receive the $3,000 from the EITC until 2023, the next year, right? So you earn the 10 grand in 2022, and you got the 3,000 EITC in 2023. The wrong year fallacy is that the way we evaluate the EITC right now is, instead of counting that 3,000 as being paid out in 2023, we treat it as if it was paid out in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
So we pull it back into a year when it wasn't into a calendar time frame where it was not even paid out. And then we say, you had that money. So we would say in 2022, your income was actually $13,000 total. Mm-hmm. $10,000 from your earnings and $3,000 from EITC. Wrong. It was $10,000 from earnings. The $3,000 from EITC didn't come until the next year. And the reason this is important is because when you allow people to count that $3,000 in the year that you didn't actually receive it, it makes the program look like it's super perfectly targeted at people right below the poverty line when it's not.
Yeah.
And that's the game people play with that statistic. And it becomes relevant to questions about targeting versus universalism, because people will say the EITC is so perfectly targeted. Look, it gets money right to the people who are just below the poverty line and whatever. And it's like, no, it only looks perfectly targeted because you're counting benefits that were paid out in 1 year as if they were paid out in the prior year when they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You're using a statistical quirk here, or not even a statistical quirk. You're using an accounting method that's factually wrong in order to allow you to look like you're perfectly targeted. That's your problem. So,
Liz, do you think it is worthwhile for someone with knowledge of abuse to come forward if the incident is hard to corroborate and the statute of limitations is passed? Yes, because you never know what it could mean to the victim. Favorite church potluck handheld main course offerings. Dude, I love funeral sandwiches. I don't know if you're familiar with this phenomenon, Matt.
No.
But they're like hot ham and cheese sliders baked on Hawaiian buns.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like a Dijon Worcestershire sauce. Sometimes there's onion in there, like chopped up, very minced, very fine. Very good. Very choice. Love a funeral sandwich. You are contacted by an alien oddities collector that wants to have a weirdo from Earth in his giant terrarium spaceship, but is looking for advice on which weirdo will be most entertaining to his alien friends. Who are your top five recs for the alien to abduct and replace with a clone? I'd love to know if either of you have ever been exposed to Posadas left-wing thought, too. Oh, yeah. Definitely been exposed to Posadas thought. Love the dolphins. Believe that they're grays. Support that enormously. Who would I suggest that they put in their big weirdo terrarium? I mean, just really entertaining people, like, I don't know, Adam Friedland.
Stand-up comics.
You want someone really funny up there?
You need someone who can be funny in a bare minimum setting, so I guess stand-up's probably your best bet.
Yeah. I don't know. Just trying to think of wildly entertaining weirdos from Earth. Danny McBride.
What about the what about like mermaid performers?
Yeah, those can be pretty entertaining. They're already entertaining to people.
They already perform in fish tanks.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Matt, what is the optimal structure of disability benefits in the ideal welfare state? Would you keep SGA limits?
SGA limits refers to substantial gainful activity limits, as we all know. My ideal structure is that you have essentially two courses for disability benefits, two paths, right? One path is for people who have severe work limitations, just like we have now, and they would receive a pretty high benefit amount, enough to, you know, that they can fully live on. And then you have another path for benefits that are for people who can still work or who still want to work or whatever. And those are based solely on the severity of the disability. So sometimes you see this described as a disability pension versus a disability allowance. So a disability pension would be someone who they just become fully paralyzed or whatever. And so you're paying them enough that they can live, you know, without working. But you might have a disability allowance for someone who is deaf, right? Someone who's deaf can still work in lots of different jobs. So they may not want to be on a disability pension because they still want to work. So you might just say, well, for everyone who's deaf, we're going to give you an extra $400 a month or whatever, right, to cover that. They do this in some countries, and you see this actually very commonly with children who have disability, because children who have disability already are not working, and in most countries they're receiving child benefits just because they're children. But if they're disabled, we also want to provide a little extra because the disabilities are costly. And so what they'll do is they'll sort, Finland has a benefit like this, they'll sort the disabled kids into one of three categories, which is sort of like super, you know, high disabled, medium disabled, and low disabled. And they have ways of sorting the kids. And depending on which category you wind in, that's how much your monthly like disability benefit is. I think you could do something similar for people who are disabled, who need money but still want to work and therefore don't want to be in this disability pension where there are limits on how much you can work. So you kind of would need to pick your path. And in a way, that could help because you could be on the disability pension one day. Let's say you have a work-limiting disability and you've decided you can't work and the state's okay with that and they think, yep, this is serious enough that you can't work. But then maybe things change and you find a job that you can do and you want to do. Well, then you can get out of the pension, get onto that job, and you would get the disability allowance. And so that would still allow you to, in a sense, stay on disability benefits of a type without being subject to the substantial gainful activity limits. So that's my idea, sort of like sort disabled people into working and non-working, and the working ones get an allowance that, you know, they can still work and receive money from working, and the non-working ones get like a full-blown pension, which is much higher and does have limitations on substantial gainful activity.
Matt, in his latest book, Piketty seems pretty down with a job guarantee, claiming it's absolutely necessary for a more just society. He specifically cites Pavlina Cherneva's ideas, who wants to design the JG as a National Care Act or something that addresses the urgent environmental and care needs of communities across the United States. She also mentions that a JG is better than giving people money because if the UI were increased, people would still want jobs. She goes on to say that the interventions that are based on providing income alone will not be fully successful. Seems to me like they work just fine for pensioners. What's your take? Have you seen evidence for people stating preferences to work over a preference for income supplements?
I'd have to see what he said about it. I think that's just wrong. I mean, just flatly wrong. Let's take the idea of, we want to employ a lot more people to do caregiving jobs, right? I think that's totally reasonable. Mm-hmm. We'd like to put more money into the home care sector to take care of elderly and disabled people. And we'd like to put more money into the child care sector to take care of kids, right? We have needs in those sectors. Okay, so here's how I would do that. I would simply allocate money to those sectors, right? I would create a child care benefit where people could go to child care. Or let's give an analogy. I would do it the way that we do K-12.
Yeah.
And you notice, like K-12, there are 50 million kids in public K-12. And we are able to fully staff. Literally, there are 100,000 school buildings in the U.S. Did you know that? K-12 school buildings.
I did not know that.
There are right at about 100,000 K-12 school buildings, and they serve 50 million kids each day for 280 days a year. And we are somehow able to pull that off without making it so that we staff those things with people who happen to be on the unemployment dole. Like, that's the thing that's so confusing about this connection over and over again. If you want to provide childcare, there are countries that have childcare free or nearly free childcare. You just hire people to do it, normal people. And you would like to hire them in these jobs in a permanent way. The job guarantee, it needs to be explained over and over again, is not just like a public job, like works program. It's not just like public employment, like K-12. It's specifically a program where when you become unemployed, as a condition of receiving your benefits, you have to go do some kind of work that the government asks you to do. And I think that that's bad in and of itself, because I would like people who are unemployed to have an opportunity to chill out, receive their benefits, and try to find other ways into the labor market that suit them. But also from the service provision perspective, that's just not a good way to provide services. Like, I wouldn't like it if my daughter's child care center was just staffed by a constantly rotating staff of whoever happens to be on unemployment benefits. That's fucking insane. You know what I mean? The same thing for like home care for elderly or disabled people. It's nice if those people make good pay, it's professionalized, and they can be consistent over time. Like, I don't think people who need home care would like to be cared for by just whoever happens to be on unemployment benefits at the time. And then when they go and get a normal job again, they go away and they get some other dude who just happened to lose his job. And that's the craziest way imaginable to provide that kind of service. So, you know, I think people get tricked into this over and over again, but I'll say at least in the U.S. discourse, it seems to have died entirely. So I let things die when they die, you know, move on. So
yeah. Matt, how do you host and update your website?
Well, I have two websites. I have mattbruning.com and I have peoplespolicyproject.org. They're both hosted on a web host called Nearly Free Speech, nearlyfreespeech.net. It is, I think, one of the cheapest hosts. It is a host that is you pay per use. So it's not, they bill you like per, you know, megabyte of data that you transfer and per megabyte of data that's stored and per PHP process. Like it's very, similar to Amazon Web Services in that regard. But this was set up like this a long, long time ago. My very first website was put up with them. So I think it's one of the cheapest hosts available. It is perhaps one of the more user unfriendly hosts, which is just to say if you're technically good with like you can enter into a shell, like a bash shell, and you can manage your website that way, which I can, but I know not everyone can. If you can do that, it's great because it's cheap and it's straightforward and you get it. And it's sort of like Linux in that regard. Linux is the simplest operating system you can use. If you know a shitload about computers, you know, but if you don't, it's impossible to use. So I use that. And how do I update it? They're both WordPress sites. So for the most part, I'm just in the WordPress content management system doing my posts like that. I should say the People's Policy Project website was fully designed by our John White graphic designer, the one who does all the papers and all that. He created a whole custom WordPress theme for it, which is beautiful.
Lovely.
So, if you're asking me that question, you got to convince John White. John White is such a talented guy. I mean, to think like he can not only do graphic design, but actually create a custom WordPress theme, which requires like coding, like
yeah.
PHP, so you got to get yourself one of those. They're not easy to find. So,
Liz, what are you baking these days? Also, any good reads, spiritual or otherwise? I've been reading Isaac the Syrian. I also called Isaac of Nineveh. He's been called many things historically. Been reading him a bit. And in terms of baking, I was thinking of making these like shortbread bars with a brown sugar cinnamon filling that are kind of meant to approximate a brown sugar cinnamon Pop-Tart. And or I've also considered just using puff pastry to make homemade Pop-Tarts with my kids. We'll see. But I've been baking with the kids a lot these days.
All right. We each can pick one more question. So, okay. Pick it carefully. I'm going to skip. So we got one from Michael Botta. Matt, I've worked as a childcare worker. I'm currently an adjunct professor. Any advice or ideas as to how these two very impoverished workforces could unionize? If you're an adjunct professor, the first question is your university public or private? If it's a public university, it's going to be subject to your state's public sector labor laws. So you'll have to figure out how does that work in your state? If you're in Texas, what are the Texas state public sector labor laws with respect to professors? If you are in a private university, you're going to be governed by the National Labor Relations Board, and you can, you know, unionizing should be pretty straightforward, right? You'll collect cards from the majority of your workforce. You'll file for an election, et cetera, et cetera. In practice, what you'll do is you'll find a union that wants to represent you. I know the United Auto Workers are one of the big unions that does operate on campuses, weirdly enough. So, you know, if I were you and I was an adjunct professor and I was really interested and I was at a private university, I would contact UAW and specifically their like university organizing stuff. They're the people who also frequently organize grad students into unions. For childcare workers, almost all of that's private, so that's going to be NLRB, same kind of thing. Who would you contact? Maybe SEIU. The problem with the child care worker situation is just that it's very, very difficult to increase pay in the child care sector because people are so constrained by what parents can pay, So people who focus on improving conditions for child care workers tend to focus more on a legislative route, because through the legislative route, you can increase subsidies, right? We need public subsidies to really make child care work. It doesn't really work as a sector unless you have public subsidies, just like K through 12 has public subsidies. So we need public subsidies to make that work. Once you get public subsidies going into those sectors, then child care pay will be able to rise. Right now, child care pay is the is in the bottom 2% of pay in the distribution of pay in the U.S. And it's very difficult to get it off that until you get those things done. D.C. is a good example of this for pre-K 3 and 4. The people who work in their sort of like quasi-public system that they have now for pre-K 3 and 4, their wages, they now make wages that are similar to, public school workers. And that's only because, you know, they've brought that all into that system. So, you know, you can unionize with childcare workers, but it's going to be tough to move the ball through the union process because the limit, again, is what the customers can pay, which is really difficult. So you got to have a two-pronged approach there.
My best friend asks, where was Jesus, according to Liz's beliefs, after the crucifixion and before the revival, before the resurrection? That's a good question. I have nothing against the harrowing of hell.
He's in the cave.
The harrowing of hell is not an early Christian belief, in my understanding. But it would certainly be a very economical use of time. And why not, you know?
When he was down there, why didn't he take care of business, you know? Finish him off for good.
Well, you know, there's a time for that. There'll be time for that.
He blew it. He blew it.
No.
All right.
All righty.
Adios, mofo. Adios, mofo.